So today is May 7th.
May 8th.
May 8th. Thank you. And I am Deborah Schwartz. I am sitting here on May 8th, 2015 with Locke McCorkle. Is that how I'm saying it right? McCorkle. And Locke, thank you very much for being interviewed by the Mill Valley Historical Society.
You're welcome.
Okay, so you have, in our pre-interview, I've learned a little bit about your very interesting life. And why don't we start with the beginning, where you were born and a little bit about your family.
I was born in San Jose, California, when it was a city of some 22,000 people and the rest were orange groves. Now there's probably not an orange tree in town. Mm-hmm. And I was the firstborn son of my dad and mom. My mom came from Missouri and my dad from Texas, and they met in Portland, Oregon, and fell in love and moved to California.
And McCorkle, that's kind of an interesting name. You said that's, what is the origin of that name?
It's Scottish.
Scottish.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I think I'm the only Locke McCorkle in the United States, but if you got into the highlands of Scotland, they're like fleas on a dog up there.
So your parents came from Portland to San Jose?
Yeah.
What brought them?
I think it was work, because you know I was born in 1930, and that was, you know, the country had blown up the year before, and jobs were tough, and so forth. So, but you know, they always seem to get one.
So, if you're born in 1930, how old does that make you?
I'm as old as God and as young as spring.
Okay. That's a good age. All right, so you grew up in San Jose. And tell me a little bit about your early childhood, just a little bit about, you know, the proximity to San Francisco and your experiences here.
Well, actually, my family moved around quite a bit. Mm-hmm. My dad worked, he was an interior decorator and usually managed a furniture store for somebody, and so we went San Jose, Modesto, Sacramento, and finally when I was 10 years old, we went to Eureka. So that's kind of where I grew up, is in Eureka. Mm-hmm. And my dad always wanted a place in the country, so we got one. We had 3.5 acres. And I joined the 4-H club, and I learned to plant things, and I'd raise chickens and rabbits, and I had a truck garden, and there was Greek gardeners across the street, and I used to go thin out carrots for them. Here I am, 11 years old, and that row of carrots to thin out looked like it went forever.
What is a truck garden?
They called the stuff that those farmers made, they called it truck. The vegetables and stuff were called truck. I don't know why they were called truck, but it was Theodore Kokkolides and Peter Apostolides. The two guys lived there that did it. And they give me 15 cents to thin that whole row. But to me, it was like found money, right? And we had big redwood stumps from old-growth redwoods. So they were 20, 25 feet wide, and they were close to the house. And Peter knew how to blast them with dynamite. So he'd come over and put dynamite under them. And, you know, didn't blow up our house, but we blew up the stumps.
So that's where you stayed through primary school and junior high and high school?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But since I'm in the Mill Valley Historical Society, I know that you made your way south from Eureka towards the Bay Area at some point.
Yeah, that was essentially after college, because I went to Humboldt State College in Arcata. And
you studied?
I studied, majored in English, minored in French. And came down to do graduate work at the University of California in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
That brought me down here. And in the summer before I went to Berkeley, my brother Bob, who left us in, I think, 1940 or about, or 50 maybe, he said, I want you to hear this program. It's called A Way Beyond the West, and a guy named Alan Watts talks. And he turned that on, it was on Sunday nights, it was a half hour. 20 minutes into that program, I said, oh, I did not know that what he has to say was even on the menu. And I just abandoned all ideas of going to the University of California and being a university professor, and turned around and went across the bridge to the American Academy of Asian Studies in San Francisco and studied with Alan Watts and Frederick Spiegelberg and Hari Das Chowdhury and I was like a kid in a candy store with a whole bag of nickels. I was probably more enlightened then than I ever have been since, because I just said, I'll have it, you know. I like it. I like the menu, please serve, you know. And I didn't see any obstacles. And it's really true, there aren't any obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get in your own way or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got some very good people that are good at helping you get out of your own way, because that's essentially what you have to do. And after I'd studied there for a while, and I was supporting myself by washing pots in a place that made food for restaurants, and I just got the... that's where I met Gary Snyder, the poet. And
at the school you were studying, teacher? Was he a fellow student?
Fellow student.
Mm-hmm.
Fellow student. He had been a great student of Native American stuff,
mm-hmm.
and he'd been a bit of a revolutionary too, a communist, which I would have been. I would have been a communist if there'd been a cell. Because it sounded better than anything else. You know, I didn't know anything about Joe Stalin and what a menace he was to everybody. There, back in the first days, I thought if you had a revolution, things would get better. I know much better than that. Now, you have a revolution, then the revolutionaries run you the same way the people that they deposed ran you before, but it's just different people running you. Oh, God.
So you were Gary Snyder, yourself.
Gary said, you know, there's, it's really nice over in Marin. And he says, I know a realtor that might be able to help us. So I got in touch with him. I've forgotten his name yet. And he found me this place in Homestead Valley, in Mill Valley, that was 2 acres with 2 houses on it, and it was $25 a month, and I got a 5-year lease on the place.
What did it look like?
Well, it was rather primitive. The house nearest the road had 4 rooms. It was 25 feet square, divided into 4 rooms, and he raised, the Italian that built it, he raised 12 kids in it, and then up at the other end of the property, he built himself a retreat.
Do you remember the guy's name who built it?
I never knew his name.
Do you remember the address of the place?
It was on Montford Avenue. No, I don't. I think.
Is it still there?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's still there. Yeah. The retreat isn't. It fell down.
The boys' club.
But the retreat is where Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac lived for a while.
And so what year are we talking right now? Approximately. You don't have to give me exact.
At the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like a good deal, and I went over there, and I learned to be a carpenter. I got tired of washing pots, and I became an apprentice carpenter in San Francisco, and I just moved over there and took my carpentry trade with me,
mm-hmm.
which I thought I was minting money there, because to go from the kind of work most people do, whether you're a student or anything else, and you go into construction, they pay you five times as much money, you know. And I thought, oh, this is great. I will just work half the year, and I'll have more money than I know what to do with. The problem is, when an employer finds out that you take responsibility for things, they don't want you to even take one day off, much less 6 months. So that never worked out. I had to work more.
How did your parents view you moving to Marin County? And And hanging out with these
They weren't here then. Where in the heck were they? I'm trying to think where they were, because when I left Mill Valley the first time, which was when I was be 1939, 57, 58, somewhere along there, I went to Tucson, Arizona, and my dad and mom lived in Eureka. Mm-hmm. Or in the country in there, but my dad had bronchitis and cirrhosis of the liver and Lou Gehrig's disease. He was a wonderful guy, but he really had a lot of stuff, and the Lou Gehrig's disease really bothered him a lot because it's painful. He liked life, and he had a flash in his eyes, but they kind of dimmed with that. But I talked him into coming to Arizona because the air would be better, mm-hmm. and it was. So by the time I really moved in, because I was in Mill Valley twice, I moved away when I went to Arizona, and with my second wife, and we went, and then I went to Spain. After that, and then I came back and lived in Florida for a couple of years, and then my marriage broke up with her, and I came back to San Francisco. And after San Francisco for a while, I went back to Mill Valley.
And so, you came in the
50s.
50s.
Yeah,
you left around.
I left around 59 or 60.
And then when did you come back?
When did I come back? 54. Let's see. The 80s.
Oh, okay. So let's go back to the 50s, because you had that really good lease going on.
Yeah.
And yeah. So you're living there and in your little rental. With
Valerie, my wife, mm-hmm. and Sita, who was for my firstborn daughter, who was born in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and so was Tasha. But Sean, my third child, the boy, was born right there in the house on Montford. I think it was 248 Montford, but I'm not sure of the address.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody wants to go, I could take them there. In fact, I took some French journalists there because they wanted to interview me and see where Jack Kerouac had, because there was a movie coming out on Kerouac, and they wanted to tie in the background, and I'm healthy and I don't die like a lot of people do. So I end up being interviewed because the rest of them died.
So Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac are living in the chicken coop or whatever you say.
Well, Gary was essentially there for the most time, and then Jack got to stay there, and then Gary went for a few years into Japan,
mm-hmm.
and Jack lived there for a while. It was interesting, of all the beats, he was the only one my wife would trust to babysit the children.
Jack Kerouac?
Jack Kerouac. And if you knew anything about him in his later years when he drank like a fish and was just a mess, but when he was sober, he was just the nicest guy you can imagine. But when he was drunk, you wouldn't want to be around him. So, I didn't, anyway.
Yeah, so you're living in Mill Valley, and how was it for the Beats and you and your family to be in Mill Valley at that time? What was,
it was great. We had parties in that little house where those of us who were willing to, we didn't have orgies, but we would dance naked to Hindu music. Except Jack. Jack would never take his clothes off. He would just sit and watch.
Continue. So that's a good party.
It was a lot of fun.
What other fun things?
It had sexual overtones, but it wasn't, we weren't doing that. Not that we wouldn't, but we didn't. Gary would have meditations up there. He converted one of the rooms to a Zen meditation room,
mm-hmm.
and then he'd have 2-hour meditations, and a half hour was always, you'd leave there and walk up Mount Tamalpais that was the walking meditation part, and so forth. So it was... And we had a wood stove. There was eucalyptus all over the property, and we'd rent a chainsaw and cut a couple of them down and slice them up, and I'd split them up into firewood, and it would last for a whole year, keep the house warm, and we cooked with it and everything like that.
Who came to... Any other Beats come and hang out with you there?
Neil Cassidy.
How was that?
The driver, Neil would arrive with a vial of marijuana joints. And, of course, the marijuana in those days was not anything like you have today. The marijuana in those days, you had to smoke a whole joint or a whole cigarette, and you had to hold your breath till you almost died, and you'd get a bit of a buzz. And if you were good at it, you could make more, because drugs are kind of funny. Actually, you do everything, and the drug is just a trigger. So if you can use the trigger properly, you can go off of it. Like, some people can take one alcoholic drink and have a great party, and others can drink a whole bottle of whiskey and they just get stupid. It's not the drug, it's how you use it.
So he would show up with his jar.
Yeah, and then he'd challenge you to a game of chess. And he chatted constantly. Well, you couldn't even think. even if you didn't smoke, he didn't care whether you smoked it or not.
He was a brain scrambler, was he?
Yeah, he just was a very intense human being. And he would tell you about the latest books he'd been reading or something like that,
uh-huh.
and so forth. He worked for the railroad, and Kerouac worked for the railroad a little bit too at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they you know, even though marijuana was absolutely illegal and on the government list, which is an absolute lie, they tell you all kinds of lies about it, and they still do to this day. The government of the United States lies about marijuana. Because there's never been one single recorded incident of anybody being harmed by it, ever. You know? And they act like you take one joint and your brain's fried for the rest of your life. So he would come by... another great poet, but Allen Ginsberg.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes he would be there, and there's another poet that I can see him very well, but I can't think of his name right now. That would come, but it was kind of a special place for the Beats, even though I was not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kenneth Rexroth would say, "Well, what's McCorkle doing here? He doesn't write anything." And I don't know, Gary would tell him something. And I keep getting invited.
And how about Alan? He was, did he?
Oh, well, I... Yeah, when I was in San Francisco, and I'd stayed with Alan Watts, and then he moved to a house that was just two blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Jack and I got the idea. They said, "Let's turn Alan on to marijuana." So we went over there and with what we had, and we taught him what we taught him.
What was what?
We had these joints.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, I don't know. It's not much to me. It's like a glass of sherry before dinner." But he hadn't caught on to it yet. Because
mm-hmm.
eventually he caught on and even said this over the air. He said, "Marijuana is nature's attempt to save itself from mankind." He could think of things to say that were...
When I first spoke to you on the phone, I called you a rascal. What is it he said to you about?
Oh, I never trust a man whose innate rascality doesn't show. And I remember him once, I was at a party, this was in Mill Valley or someplace, and this guy was saying, "Well, so-and-so can only get to the sixth level, and this one that I've been studying with can get to the eighth level." And Alan says, "Well, if a man's a damn fool on the first level, he's going to be a damn fool in the eighth."
So you had your cadre of Buddhist...
Yeah.
Beat...
Buddhists and
beat Beats. Family members with your family and your children and...
Yeah, yeah. It was... And I had a good job as a carpenter with... In fact, I worked in San Francisco most of the time because I worked for a... contractor that did remodeling work, and so that's where I first got into motorcycles. I had a motorcycle that I used to go to work in.
Uh-huh.
They thought that was, "How do you take a motorcycle? Where are you going to put your tools?"
Yeah.
Well, I'd take a car and get the tools to the job, and then I'd leave them there until the job was done, right?
Uh-huh. So you mentioned a little bit ago that they asked, "What's McCorkle doing here?" Because he's not a writer. But in fact, you did become a writer.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to be, but I didn't know what to say. And that's when I went away from there with my second wife. And we went to Spain because she read that if you're going to write a book and you're an American, you have to be in Greece or Spain where you have enough time. But we had my fourth child was David, and he was an extremely retarded Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, all he did was go, ah, with his tongue hanging out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary and I kept him for 8 years, which I do not recommend that anybody do that. It's too hard on everybody, even though Mongoloids are not demanding. They just require a lot of attention. And the other kids get neglected comparatively good. So you only got so much time. But what did I do? What did I start with?
You were saying you went to say you're right.
And when I was over there, she said, look, I've got a Mary said, I've got a suggestion for a book for you to write, but you've got to promise me you're going to seriously consider it, or I won't even mention it. Because, and I said, okay. She said, I've had quite a few lovers, and none of them compare with you. Why don't you write a book on how to make love? And I said, okay. And we smoked some hashish. You get hashish over there instead of marijuana. And I came up with all the chapter headings at once, and then I sat down 6 mornings a week at 9 a.m., and I didn't get out of the chair till 1, whether if the writing either came or it didn't. And when I got it all written, I sent it to Grove Press, to an editor there that I knew, that Gary had introduced me to, and they said, yeah, we'll publish it.
And the book is How to Make Love, The Spiritual Nature of Sex by Locke McCormick.
Yeah, I was just using that title as a working title. Mm-hmm. I wanted a title, 3-word title, like, I don't know, good, bad, and indifferent, or eat, pray, love, you know, something ringy like that. But they didn't want to change it. They liked it. They liked that How to Make Love thing.
How did Beats take this book? Were any of them still around by then? What year is this?
This was published, and it doesn't mean anything because I don't talk about it in the book, but 1969.
Oh.
And,
Well, now you're a writer.
Yes.
And you must have done an awful lot of research.
I just wrote it. Partly one of the reasons I wrote it is that I had met this incredible teacher while I was living in Mill Valley, who taught in San Francisco. He taught drama. His name was David Hunter, and he taught drama in this adult division of the San Francisco City Schools. Mm-hmm. And there was a little school in Pacific Heights. Well, this drama class that he taught was beyond anything I've ever heard of or seen even since. And this was back in the 50s. And It was an approach that was so profound. You didn't interpret a character. You didn't memorize the lines or anything. He taught you how to focus on your senses. He started out with hearing and then seeing. But when you're seeing, he just had you slightly open your eyes and so forth. It was all designed to get you into present time. Humans are hardly ever experiencing present time. Or when they are experiencing present time, they don't know it, because that's when their thinking is not functioning. And they are really here, but don't know they're here. But he had a way of getting it. So you would just let the words kind of come out of your mouth, whatever way they would come out. And when they came out in a way that he liked, he'd say, set that. And then he expected you to come out exactly the same way every time. But you still didn't, you still had this focus. It would be on your senses, you know. I mean, it was touch, sight, sound. I know one of my Buddhist friends I lived with, we did this play called The Orange Cellar that David Hunter wrote, and Claude Dallenberg came to it, who was a Zen person, and he came to every performance, and he said, I never saw anything like the same play twice. I didn't know because I was just in it.
But you were interested to take this acting class.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I'd taken acting in high school, and I'd taken acting in college at Humboldt State. I liked acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a certain amount of charisma, which David called brain radiation. He said, people that have that, the audience will look at them, whether they're any good or not.
How does a person have that?
I don't know. They're just, it's like George Clooney. I mean, he is a hell of a good actor, but it wouldn't matter because he is so magnetic to look at. You're going to look at him. If he's on the screen, you're going to look at him.
How about your friends? Which of your friends had that quality? Do you think any of them did?
Well, Ginsberg kind of did. He would probably more than any of the rest of them. Yeah, it's interesting. It just and then if you can combine that with learning your craft, you can be something really terrific. But I didn't want to learn to be an actor, and also no movie company or theater company was interested in his approach,
mm-hmm.
because it was too unusual.
Mm-hmm.
We had some professional actors come and take it and love it, but they said, I can't take it back with me and use it there because there's not the context.
But for you, I'm sort of getting that it was a life philosophy as well.
Not only that, I had a peak experience on it that actually went to my head a lot. One of the things about enlightenment or anything else, if the ego gets a hold of it, you're in trouble no matter what. And mine did. I moved into a state where I thought I was something really special and I could do anything. And, I apologized to anybody I might have run over at that time. But, and when it went away, I felt like I just lost my mother. I didn't like losing it at all.
How long did you have it for?
6 weeks.
So those classes took you to that place?
Something happened. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was a combination of things, right. And, and I used to, when David Hunter was sick or something, I would teach the class. because he does not show up, and so I would just do what he did. Oh, and why I did it, because the book on how to make love, the first chapter is based on what I learned from David Hunter as to making love, because as I mentioned before, I wrote it for men, although women bought it. And I had some of the women who told me, how do I get my guy to read it? I said, almost hide it. Well, you can't hand a man a book on sex and say, you need this, because he just shrivels up at the thought, right? Men are, what was it? Mary White or said something like, balls? Who wants to have balls? They are sensitive.
Oh, Betty, was it the actress?
Yeah.
In her 90s now.
Yeah, right, right.
She said, you should want to take be a uterus. Those things can take a pounding.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yes. It's just, or a vagina.
Take a vagina. It takes a pounding.
So.
But that's how that got there.
And did you, at that time, and you don't have to answer this if you don't care to, while you're in this acting class, which is a rather esoteric experience, there were other things going on in the 60s as well that were rather esoteric. You had been smoking pot, but new drugs were coming into the scene then too.
Yeah. I have to kind of separate the two times I lived in Mill Valley because they were such different times. I did all that then, and then it was after I came back from Spain and Florida and San Francisco and took Est and went to Mexico as a dropout, and I hated it. I didn't not hate Mexico. I love Mexico, but I hated being a dropout. It's not my style.
So when you drop off, you mean like tune in, turn on, and drop out?
Yeah, not my style. In fact, one of the things I found out, I used to think I wanted to be a European, but really I wanted espresso, coffee, and cappuccinos, which they had there and didn't have here, which has all been changed now. but when I lived in Spain, I said I could never stay here. They're much too slow. I really realized how American I was, how we're an energetic lot here at our best, you know. And down here in Silicon Valley, it's almost worse because they even race you to the stop sign in their cars. You know?
So for those that are listening, you left Mill Valley and you're now living in Palo Alto.
So
you're back in the 60s in Mill Valley, and you've traveled a bit, and you've tuned in, turned on, and dropped out, and then you reapplied, or however you reengaged.
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think of how I got from there to here. When I thought I was a reborn God incarnate, I left my first wife and children. I saw that they were lined up with a wonderful old friend of mine who married my ex-wife and raised my children for me and did a wonderful job. But still, I don't recommend doing that. At least the way I did it. And I ended up apologizing to my children and my ex-wife much later. And bless their hearts, they accepted the apology. Well, they're really good people. Wonderful people. They still live up there in the woods in a place called Whitethorn, which is west of Garberville, which is north of Mill Valley, about 200 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, how did that happen? Because I came back, I lived in San, I came back, when I came back from Europe, I lived in San Francisco for a while and worked construction again. I had my own company.
And were your friends gone by then? Had they moved on to other places?
Yeah.
Or were you still reconnected?
No. I sort of pretty well lost connection with them when I spent 5 years in the desert in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And, I didn't even discover the Beatles until what's that great album they wrote? Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out, and I read about it in Time magazine in Palma de Mallorca, Spain. And I said, wow, this looks really interesting. So I was kind of out of town when a lot of things were going on. And when the great hippie movement set in, I was kind of not interested in it, because when they all talked about, they wanted to smoke pot and go to the country, and I had lived in the country and I knew what it was like, and I think the country is good, but it's a lot of work. You don't just sit around smoking pot. You dig and you garden and you take care of the hogs and the chickens and the rabbits and the calves and the sheep, and it's a lot of work, you know, and that isn't what they were thinking at all. You know, they were kids that were born, they thought milk came out of a carton and water comes out of a tap. Well, I was lowered down into a 45-foot well by my dad to take a dead rat out of it. So I knew that water just didn't come out of a tap. You had to take care of it, mm-hmm. and keep it clean and so forth. So
the hippies didn't really interest you so much.
No. I remember remodeling a dope dealer's house in the Haight. He said, I don't think my house is too firm. I went underneath it, and every one of the studs holding the house up would collapse in my hand. The house was held up by its habit of being there for 100 years.
Held up by its habit.
And the houses on either side, they were all playing the same game, right? He said, well, can you straighten this out? I put a marble on the floor. No matter what room I'm in, it rolls some other way. And I said, no, it's not going to change. It's gotten that way. It's settled into it, you know.
So you're going to Haight-Ashbury at this time, and all that's going on?
Yeah, I was building secret places for him to put his stash of marijuana so he, you know, it wouldn't be obvious. It's still against the law, except for you got medical marijuana in California. But
so what was it like over there in the Haight? What year is this about? Is this the summer of love?
Yeah.
So you're going in and out of the Haight-Ashbury?
No, I just fixed his house. Mm-hmm. I pretty much just followed my own sense of what I wanted to do with my life, and I knew what really turned me on, and the one thing that I thought was a miracle about it was that how everybody could have sex with everybody and nobody ever caught anything. And now you do anything and you get some sort of disease. You know, we didn't have AIDS, we didn't have, you know, we had syphilis and gonorrhea, but you practically never caught that even, you know. So I thought it was a special age that somehow those rules were suspended or so forth or whatever. It's a mysterious world we live in. Mm-hmm. But it goes through periods. But what my second time stint in Mill Valley was largely when I came over there, and when I came back from. Oh, yeah. Then I went into business I went into business in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which I am still in business in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I have 16 Supercuts salons in Tulsa. The business part is run by a 44-year-old blonde type A bombshell who takes control of everything, bless her sweetheart, and loves to send me checks every month. And we love each other a lot. But she takes care of all that. And when I, my third wife, Barbara, flew out there when I was building the stores in Tulsa. We were living in not Homestead Valley, like I'd lived in before, but the place a little bit south of that. They got us.
Tam Valley?
Yeah. They're living in Tam Valley where they had all those big shingle houses. And we'd bought one of those. And I'd mortgaged it to build the first store. And Barbara flew out once and she says, "I can't get it up for you anymore. Let's get a divorce."
So that's number three.
That was number three, right? That's right.
Would you like me to get you a glass of water? Would you like to pause for a moment?
Yeah.
Okay, let's just pause for just a second. Okay, we are recording. All right. Gosh. So you're.
It was interesting, though. We did get a divorce, and many years later, I was at a class that I was really interested in, and Barbara, my third wife, was in there. She says, "Come up here in the front row and sit with me." And then she announces the whole group. She says, "Ours is a divorce that never needed to happen. It's the first I heard of it." And then when the class was over and we parted, I said, "But if you hadn't divorced me, I wouldn't have met Sumire, and we wouldn't have discovered this class." It was in Health Realization, and it was fantastic. And she smiled and looked at me and she says, "Well, one door closes, another one opens."
It's a good attitude.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about Est. When did Est become a part of your life?
Well, it was after I came back from Spain. Oh, and then my second wife, Mary, she forgave me for my sins, and we were living together in San Francisco, but it didn't work out. And so she went back to Florida, and I fell in love with this Filipina lady, half Filipina and half Irish. Her name was Lydia. She's still a close friend. She lives in New York. And somehow she heard, she got interested in the S training, so we took it together. And I saw that it was like the happening thing in San Francisco. And I like to be where things are happening. So I went to, is it working?
Yep, it's working.
So I said that they had a class that to teach seminar leaders. And I went in it. And I kind of flunked the class. In fact, Stuart Emery said, "I don't know if we're ever going to get you in front of 250 people doing this or not." But I tell you one thing, Werner needs help over in his house, and you really like him, and you're a carpenter and a tradesman and stuff. So why don't you go over there?
Why don't you say for people that may not know about Est who Werner is?
Oh, Werner Erhard was the founder of EST. The EST means Erhard Seminars Training. And he had a way of getting people to see beyond what they usually see. And he developed this training, and it became very, very popular in San Francisco during, let's see, the early 70s. Yeah, because I worked for him actually 5 years to the day. I quit after 4 years, but it took a year for him to find somebody to take my place. In fact, they never did.
So you were first a carpenter, and then what did you have?
The guy that was managing Werner's house said, "I'm leaving. How about you being the house manager?" So I said, "Okay." Well, I did everything. My dad taught me how to cook, so I was a pretty good cook. So I'd cook him his food, and he never told me what to fix. So I always cooked what I wanted, and it turned out that he wanted it too.
Give me an example of a typical lock meal.
Oh, I don't remember what I cooked in those days. It might have been a beef stew or gosh knows what. You know, sometimes I'd get creative and do stuff. And if he didn't eat it all, I'd eat the rest. And sometimes he'd say, "Hey, I want seconds." And I'd say, "Too late."
Did you eat together, or did he have...
No, I didn't eat with him. The only thing together we did is after everybody had left for the day, he and I would sit in his expanded office on the third floor of this house in Franklin Street, smoke great Cuban cigars that I imported from Switzerland. I had people say, "Aren't you afraid they're going to arrest you for those forbidden cigars?" I said, "No, I'm only afraid the post guys are going to steal them." But I don't. and drink and sip 1945 port wine and talk about the beauties of ladies and stuff like that.
Oh, this is quite gentlemanly.
Yeah, well, I was 7 years older than he. Uh-huh. You know, so it wasn't like I was the same as the young people that were idolizing him.
How old were you then, about? Oh, well, did
you... I was in my...
40s.
40s,
yeah.
Right. And he was 7 years younger.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked him. You know, eventually I got him a really great cook who turned out to be my fourth wife. That's Sumi Ray. Not then, but she's just an old friend at that time.
So, and you mentioned on the phone that people, all kinds of people came and went from that house.
Oh, yeah. It was, I think the biggest thing was he got this idea that he wanted to put the top particle physicists of the world together in a room under ideal circumstances and see what would happen to have those minds all in one. So the thing was, how is this guy, Werner Erhard, who does Erhard Seminars Training, which my fourth wife, Sumi Ray, called, he's the Tom Jones of the guru set.
You mean the singer character?
How is he going to get these physicists to take him seriously? So the plan was we'd start with the one over in Berkeley who had a French wife. So we invited him.
His name, do you recall?
I don't remember him. But I remember his French. The funny thing about it was I was the greeter at the door, I was the maitre d', I ran everything, and I made sure everything happened well at the dinner. But towards the end of it, I like to participate, and I often would. And some of the people that came there, I had known in other contexts, from the American Academy of Asian Studies or stuff like that. And the rest of the staff didn't like it, but it didn't bother Werner that I participated. But in this one, he said, "Okay, your job is to charm his wife." So I got really good French wines, and I made sure she saw the labels when I was pouring it and so forth. And about halfway through the meal, she looks at her husband. Her husband's name was Jeffrey. I don't remember. It started Jeffrey with a G, none of the rest of it. And she looked over at him and she says, "Jeffrey, I'm charmed." And I said, "I wonder if that's how a golfer feels when he makes a really long putt."
I'm charmed.
I'm charmed. And that built it into, we finally did. We had, Furman was the one that I liked the best because he was the most at home. But the most famous one we had there was Hawking's.
Oh, Stephen Hawking's
Stephen
there.
Hawking's,
Well,
right.
Furman's pretty famous too.
Yeah, what he the atomic bomb and everything else, but he was really very friendly. We just sat and talked for a while and stuff like that. It didn't matter that I was just a waiter, so to speak, and stuff like that. But yeah, and when we got them all together, they were down at Emilio's having dinner when Stephen Hawking showed up. I thought he'd want to be sent to a quiet room or something like that. He said, "No, I want to join the party."
He
I
was
mean,
talking then? Yeah.
no, through interpreter. He talked, but I didn't understand what he said. And so I found a guy that had a van, and I got him in there and so forth. And we went down there, and the owner of Emilio's met us at the door and stuff like that. Oh, and in the meeting room was 3 stories up. These narrow stairs, and I had to, get Stephen Hawking carried up there in his wheelchair. And the head of the staff said, "Locke, if you drop Stephen Hawking."
How about
But it was the interesting thing was, I was the only non-physicist in the room. And they talked mathematics, of course, and I didn't know anything, but I could hear the music in it. I was just supplying them with cappuccinos and stuff like that. It was
Warner wasn't there?
no.
Was Carl Sagan? Did he come?
Who?
He's Carl Sagan? Did
No.
he? No? It was
Nope.
just these physicists.
Huh?
Just the physicists.
Yeah. Yep. Wheeler was one of them. I can't remember, and it was a while back, but there was, I don't know, 15 or so. It was, and whatever actually came of it, I think he did another one after I left. And then the other thing that Werner always liked to do, he'd like to turn people on to I'm thinking the great black comedian that,
Richard Pryor?
yes, he would play Richard Pryor records for, I don't care what guest it was or anything like that. Because, he picked up. Pryor was an incredible comedian. He just was out of this
He was a
world.
cultural mirror. He somehow managed to distill that
Well,
culture at that
and
time.
he never made fun of somebody else at that person's expense. He made fun of himself, but the himself that he made a fun of was just like you and me. So he made fun of all of us, including himself. It was great. And at some time, as I said, I got my third wife, Sumire, over there because she was a world-class cook.
But I thought this was the fourth.
Fourth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, hard to keep track.
As a cook, because she came over here when she was 22, and I met her through her father, who came over to teach at the American Academy of Asian Studies, mm-hmm. where I was studying with Alan Watson stuff before. So I'd known Sumi Ray since she was in her early 20s. And this was much later. But I got her to come there, and Werner said, you really should take the training. You had to take a vow that you wouldn't get up and go to the bathroom or anything else like that, you know. And she said, well, I'm not going to do that. She went to her doctor and had him write up a bunch of stuff that she could come and go, because she wasn't going to play that game, you know.
Did you do that? Did you do the training where you couldn't go to the bathroom and all that, where they break you down, correct?
Yeah. But, you know, in those days I could hold it forever anyway. So I didn't have to pee down my leg like God knows how many people did. I couldn't do it now.
Did Warner take those trainings where he was put in those positions?
No. No, he just thought them up.
What was it like for you living in a household where there may very likely have been, I mean, a lot of sycophants or idol worshiping, or all, you know, the whole notoriety of being this new thing, this new spiritual.
Yeah. I just liked it that I was in doing a going thing.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it for 4 years, and then I didn't want to do it anymore. And I said, I quit. And Werner said, he announced the staff. He says, Locke is one of the few people that I'm going to let resign. But then they kept trying to get somebody to take my place, and we'd get these people that were really qualified. They'd run hotel divisions or something like that. But when they really got what my job involved, they would disappear in the middle of the night like people that didn't want to pay the rent.
Why? What was it that was so particular?
I can remember once in a morning I was doing some Tai Chi and I just fell over and landed on the floor because I just had so little sleep. I couldn't stand up.
Oh, they just ran you into the ground then?
Yeah.
Work, work, work.
Work, 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 work. He would have everything that he thought of written up into a thing that he calls, I don't know, so it didn't get lost, so he'd keep it. So he would give me all these things to do while he was awake, and then there's all these written things to do while he slept, like, what am I going to do, right? So there was a big drawer in the library, and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to take these things and throw them in that drawer every time I get one and see if anything comes of it. Nothing did. So I found ways to do the job. I was probably perfect for the job because my personality worked with it good, but I wasn't very conscious about taking care of the plants. And Werner's a Virgo, and, you know, he sees everything and he's fussy. So I got a lot of chewing out for not taking care of the plants. But
how did it pay?
The pay was $75 a week for a long time. And I think it got up to $1,500 a month or something like that. The period that I was working for them is before they made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It was when he was doing everything he could to avoid taxes so he could reinvest in his company.
Mm-hmm.
And, they, you know, later got him in trouble, but it wasn't real trouble because the tax guy that he's using was really smart. The government does that. It tends to it will tax you so much that you can't function.
Mm-hmm. So you, after 4 years, you put in your resignation and you lasted a little longer, and now you.
I went into I went into real estate for a couple of years, but I didn't like it.
Still in the Bay Area?
Yeah.
Did you go back to Mill Valley?
Not yet. Not yet. I went back to Mill Valley when I fell in love with when my old friend Sumi Ray became my new love. And I really I fell as hard as you can as you could about somebody you never even knew, and we'd known each other for years and liked each other for years, and suddenly it was something else. Because she'd divorced her husband 10 years ago. And so that's when I came back over there. It was in the, let's see, I was probably, I think I was about, let's see, 67. I would be, oh, I'll have to stick with it. I'm as old as God and young as spring because I don't have it. You know,
Had the time.
one of the things, if anybody listening to this, you can try, is if you pretend that you don't, that nobody told you how old you were, and you just sit there and say, "How old am I?" You won't come up with an age. Because there isn't one, you know. It's like time. There isn't any time either. We put that on, you know, the days, the weeks, the months, the hours, and so forth. Because I live with a dog, and he doesn't. He knows when
And a very nice wife,
it
too.
right in a very nice way. He knows when it's time to eat and go to bed. But you know, as far as he doesn't wear a paw watch.
So you are, you're now in Mill Valley later,
Yeah,
at a later time.
at a later time.
And has Mill Valley changed?
Well, it did for me because I was in a completely different. We lived up on Tamal Pius Avenue,
Where?
77 Tamal Pius Avenue. It was the banana belt. The hills over where Tam Valley is would catch the fog, and it would stop there. And the sun would shine down, so it never got really hot, but it never got really cold.
I lived on Tamal Pius. It's lovely, that middle ridge.
Oh yeah?
Were you below McGee or above it?
Below what?
McGee or above it? The street McGee. You know how Tamal Pius goes up and then there's McGee and then you can go further and it's Ralston. If you keep on going, you're.
Yeah, no, we it was just on Tamal Pius Avenue, which is that sharp left.
So right up there
Yeah.
between Summit and McGee.
Right.
Yeah, very
Right.
nice there.
Right.
Yeah, so you're there now and you're in the banana belt. It's warmer.
Oh, it was fantastic. And that's where I had another great experience there because what was it, 89, when they had the big quake and then the big fire over in Oakland? And I looked around at where I was living in Mill Valley, and it was a tinderbox. And my then wife, Sumi Ray, said, "Well, why don't you organize something?" She said, "I'll support you in it, but I won't do it." And so I invited the neighbors of about 30 houses in kind of a circle. And we got together, and then we got into a project. There was a no way out except through the regular road, but there was a a canyon near our house that was full of brush and stuff like that, and we organized, volunteered, and took the brush out of it and built some stairs so that we could get the kids out and stuff like that. And I'd have meetings, and the people would come to meetings. And it was funny. People who had lived in the same neighborhood for 20 or 30 years and had only said hi to each other got to know each other. And then when we did this project together, it was, especially with the people that worked on it every week, like I did, because I had my carpenter skills. And then we had an architect who came from elsewhere. His name was Frank, and he helped us. And then the neighbors that worked on it, and we really bonded through that. You know, you may get to know somebody in a coffee shop, but you don't know them like you know them if you work shoulder to shoulder, and especially if it's manual. And it was a lot of it. And two of them, Jerry and Monroe and Annie, were actors, but they were really good workers at it and stuff like that. And we worked that, and then we'd have the whole community come on days when we had to take dirt and take down and fill up the steps.
Is it the steps that's right above McGee, or that drop down to Throckmorton?
Yeah.
You built those?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was quite a project. I have a picture sitting up there of all of us that they put together when Simone had she gave me a 70th birthday party here. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise party. And how she managed to do that, I have no idea. But I was out with a friend motorcycling and came home. I was in my leathers and my whole suit. And one of her friends walked me through the house. And in the backyard, I opened the door to the backyard. And they said, 70 people said, happy birthday. I thought I was in a movie because I had never seen anything like that except in the movies. You know, they do it quite often in the movies. And then I said, but it can't be a movie. There's my firstborn daughter and her husband and my business partner from Tulsa.
So was it in this house here?
Yeah, in the backyard.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was she had a jazz band and caterers. And
were the people from Tamalpais there?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a photograph before I go of that, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Group.
Yeah, and they made up that picture that's up there on the stairway. Mm-hmm. As a present for it. That they came here and so forth.
So that was your community. You became to, it brought the entire neighborhood
yeah.
closer together.
Yeah, I tried to do the same here when I moved to Palo Alto. I couldn't do it. People wouldn't do it. You have a slight threat of flooding here. Mm-hmm. But I guess it was just the times. The fact that there'd been this horrendous fire over in the East Bay. And I used to get fire people to come to our meetings. And I remember one guy, he used to tickle me because he'd call a shingle house kindling.
Of course, now Mill Valley has the evacuation routes clearly marked and with arrows.
Well, they need them.
Yes.
They need them because if that catches fire, you're not going to stop it.
It's a 1929.
You know, and one of the things that's happened to all these communities around here is the real estate values, the prices have gone up so high that the people that do the work, like firemen and policemen and stuff like that, can't afford to live there. So they're not going to come off duty and help because they're not going to be there.
Very good point.
It's really a bad idea to have that, because, but even if they were all, if they lived there, you still, it was still, they all told us, you guys got to count on yourselves and each other, because there, it will be more than we can handle.
Right.
And it's still that way. And if you're not in a community, I know we had, who would you call? Whose kids would need help? Who's got old people in their house that might need some help? All that stuff. And we were really into it. And I tell you, it felt great. You know, thank God we never got really tested. But it had a great feeling. So I lived there. I lived there in Tamil Pious Office for about 12 years, and then Sumi Ray passed away with cancer.
I'm sorry.
And the house wasn't mine. She was going to give it, part of it, to me, and I said, no, it's your children's house. You know, so I ended up homeless. My parents are dead, so I'm an orphan. And I don't own the house, so I'm homeless.
Got your motorcycle, I suspect.
Right.
Let's go back a little, where you first were with Alan Watts and Gary Snyder and all those, and you were practicing Buddhist then, correct?
Well, I was a serious student of it. I never joined a religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was almost pretty much that time that they had the Zen Center in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And Suzuki, the master of it, was just about as good as anybody you're ever going to get any place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was fantastic. But if they organize it, I'm leery
mm-hmm.
of organizations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't like them. The Supreme Court says these organizations are people. I thought, you got to be kidding.
Well, you have in your book the spiritual nature of sex. So maybe you can explain a little about what you regard as spiritual.
Ultimately, everything. But some things are more obvious to me. Sex is one of them for me. Although when the Playboy reviewer reviewed my book, he says, it's a good book, but it sounds towards the end like, he says, have sex and see God. And that didn't fly too well with Playboy.
May I ask, when you said your wives forgave you for your sins, would one of those sins have been, were you a bit of a playboy?
No.
No, okay.
I really wasn't. You know, and given the times and how loose they were.
Yes.
Ask. You know, I wasn't a prude, but no, it was, my sin was just abandoning that family the way I did. I mean, And of course, it wasn't obvious that how I helped set it up for them to all get taken care of, because
mm-hmm.
I certainly would have taken care of them if it hadn't. But I really wanted to be, when I realized that my first wife was not interested in the spirit like I was, I just didn't feel that we could continue on that. And it's still that way. She is an artist. That's her connection.
Mm-hmm.
And she's good. And she connects that way and so forth. But
for you, spirit is something else.
Yeah, it's well, sometimes I don't usually talk this way because motorcyclists are mostly, you know, they kind of think of themselves as He-Man. But to me, riding motorcycles fast is spiritual. And riding them the way we used to ride them. I did the, for 10 years, I did the Marin County ride that starts at that ARCO station in, that's Mill Valley where the ARCO is, right? When
you, over on Seminary Drive?
Yeah.
Yeah, so right off 101?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's where we'd start. And then we'd go Highway 1 all the way up to Tamales Bay.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, I haven't seen those riders in a very long time.
I think they're still doing it every Sunday.
Huh.
And I did it for 10 years, and why I'm still alive, I don't know. I'm a much better rider now. I took chances then that I can't imagine how I got away with them. But the leaders of that ride knew it was spiritual, even though a lot of people thought it was competition or something like that. But, and it's that way with me now. To me, there's no meditation more profound than riding a motorcycle at speed on a racetrack when you forget that you have a name even, much less a wife and a home and a business and children and so forth. You don't have anything. There's just you and the motorcycle. And you better be paying attention and be really tuned into it. And at the end of the day, it's like everything has been washed away. You're no longer, it's just like an intense vacation, even though it was only for a day.
But doesn't it require great concentration to
yeah.
do it?
Yeah.
But that is your vacation.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're not, your idle thoughts just, there ain't no room for them. You can't even think, you know, if you do something, if you take a corner particularly well and you think, boy, I did that one good, you're screwed. Because you went backwards and your wife, your bike is going forward and you ain't there. So you'll probably bungle the next two or three corners.
So it really keeps you in that present moment at
yeah.
all times.
Yeah, yeah. Because your mistakes hurt and they cost money. It's not like, oops on a motorcycle is not like knocking the milk off the table. You know, it's a nuisance to have milk all over the table and the floor, but when it's oops on your motorcycle.
Have you usually fallen? Have you oopsed on your motorcycle?
Oh, yeah. I've fallen off at 100 miles an hour on a racetrack. And it was no big deal. I mean, I dressed for it and stuff like that, and I didn't hit anything that stopped my body. As long as it slides and rolls and tumbles, it's usually okay. If you hit something solid, it's like jumping off the top of a Empire State Building. If you didn't hit the ground, you'd be okay, right? But it's the hitting the ground that causes the problem. See, motorcyclists dress to crash and try not to.
And what is your motorcycle that you ride? What's the kind of motorcycle? I mean, I've got a photo, but for those listening.
Oh, it's a 1,000cc. It's actually a very powerful race bike that's friendly enough you can ride it on the street.
A BMW.
The BMW, mm-hmm. right. It's an HP4, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
BMW in 2009 decided to make a race bike. They'd never made one before. They made all these touring bikes. And they did a great job. They copied the best.
So let's go back just a little, and then we'll start to get closer to the end of this. But you're orphaned. Your wife is gone. Your house is gone. And we sort of walked away from that a little bit ago. And you're in an opportunity for another, one door is shut, another is opened. What happened?
You mean after Sumi Ray passed?
Yes.
I had a neighbor up there on Tamil Pious Avenue that lived up the street a ways, that she says, I think I know why Sumi Ray died. And she said, you probably get a glimpse if you listen to these tapes by Carolyn Mice.
Oh, I know.
And I did, and it made a lot of sense to me.
Why People Don't Heal, I believe is the name.
This was something else, but I mean, she's written quite a few things, but this was, I forget what it was, but it was a album of CDs, and I got so interested, I decided to go up to Washington State and go to a seminar that she was doing. And when I got on the plane, I saw these two ladies walk by with one of her books under their arms, and I put two and two together. I said, they're probably going the same place I am. So I walked back and I said, are you interested in sharing a taxi? I used to live that way, too. When I worked for Werner Erhard, parts of my life, the first house I had in Tamil Pious Valley, I rented a big house and then rented out rooms. I found that out, and I did that when I was going to the American Academy of Asian Studies in San Francisco, that I could live much more elegantly that way than I could living in a little apartment. And you just have to have a few rules and get everybody to agree on them, and then you live it. And so I got very used to that. Wait a minute, I forgot what I was...
Carolyn Mice, you're carpooling with her.
Yeah. So I went to her thing, and I liked it a lot. And one of the things she said in it, she had a challenge. She says, I want you to do something that you're afraid to do. And I have a tough time finding anything that I'm afraid to do. So, is this the plumber?
Good. Yes, it is. Okay, continue.
So she said, she challenged us to do something that you're scared of. And I thought, well, what am I scared of? Oh, I think it's kind of scary if I get up in front of everybody and ask her to go out with me tonight. So I did. I said, how about going out with me tonight? And you know what she said? She said, did my mother put you up to this? And I said, no. And she said, well, My traditional way of doing it, things is I take the staff of all the people that helped me put this on out. And that's what I'm going to do. I'll take a rain check. But I think the two ladies that I'd met on the plane kind of got impressed with that. And a week after I was here, one of them called me and said that she knew a very beautiful lady that might be interested in me. Would I like her number? And so they gave me Simone's number. And I called her up. And she was disgusted with men at that time, and she just blew me off. And I think a week later, I decided to call again, and that time she, I don't know, she'd asked me, I didn't know she was an astrologist and a psychic and all that stuff, but she got my astrological stuff and she took it to another astrologer and she says, "My God, he's 18 years older than I am. Couldn't you get me somebody younger?" And the astrologer said, you couldn't have handled the guy he was 18 years ago.
Enter wife number 5.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. I know we're a little short on time here, so I just, that's a great story. I just want to say, now, you had a very interesting life. You've been, you know, listening to your story, you have been surrounded by great minds, articulate voices,
yeah,
innovators,
yeah,
social activists,
yeah,
maniacs, you know, charismatic leaders.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot.
Yeah.
And you're now old as God and young as spring. You're still going strong, and you're very articulate yourself. Maybe you would share a little bit, if you could say anything to anybody younger listening to this interview about your observations or thoughts about, as you've gotten older, maneuvering through life.
Well, I think one of the best things anybody could do that's younger was Google Steve Jobs' commencement address at Stanford University and pay attention to every word he said, which is no problem doing that. It is, if you're going to be a follower, it's not going to be a very interesting life. You want to break loose of all that. Don't put any head above, like one of the great Zen masters said, put no head above your own. That doesn't.
Oh, we've got somebody to the door. I'm going to pause this.
Yeah, he just knocked that it was there, I think.
Yes, yes, no head above your own.
Put no head above your own. That doesn't mean you don't consult with other people and so forth. But you don't think anybody, whoever, is going to take care of you. Not the president, not the Congress, not the police force, not the church. Nobody is going to take care of you. You need to take care of you. And you need to take care of yourself well. You got to be your first choice would be to take care of yourself, because your happiness will lie in taking care and serving other people. But if you're not in good shape, you can't do it. So it's not selfish to take care of yourself, because that's the only self you've got to share. So I know all kinds of people that just don't take care of themselves. They let their bodies go to pot. I usually tell people, you get 30 years from your birth till 30 years old, you can do almost anything with your body you want. But after that, you better pay attention and take care of it, or you're going to have a tough time. I was having some dizzy spells, so they had me go to the heart doctor, which I did yesterday. They did heart murmurs, throat things, they did blood tests, they did about everything you can think of. And the doctor comes into me and he says, "You know, there's nothing wrong with anything. You got one little piece of calcium in one of your aortas that is never going to bother you a bit. And everything is just the way it's supposed to be." You know, and I haven't been fussy. I've smoked hundreds of cigars. I've smoked thousands of cigarettes. I don't smoke much now. But I smoked long enough. And my dad smoked all the time, so I was a secondhand smoker, and it didn't bother me. I'm not recommending that people smoke because, you know, I think it's a bad habit. I'm down to one a week.
So, I mean, you certainly look healthy, and you have plans. I mean, you are going to go on a trip soon.
Yeah, I'm going out on a high alpine motorcycle tour through Austria, Switzerland, Germany, and Italy.
Wow. Oh, one thing I neglected to ask you about, I think we kind of passed this one over, and I know I'm going to get in trouble if I don't ask about it. Dharma Bums, the book.
Oh, yeah?
Jack Kerouac's book.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jack wrote Dharma Bums. He wanted to, it was principally about Gary, which he called, I think, Jaffe Ryder. But since I was the other guy in it, he put me in, I think, as called Sean Monahan.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it's Jack was one of the, I guess I was one of the few people that had followed Buddhist philosophy that he'd ever met, because until he came out here, he never knew anything about Buddhism. He learned it all from Gary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're immortalized in that book. Do you think it's a good representation of yourself?
I'd have to take a look at it again. I just think it's an interesting one, because there's a lot of me's. I feel that I've had probably a half a dozen lifetimes. Every one of my marriages has been an entirely different life. Because I count on the woman in my life a whole lot. The spirit of it. To me, a man's mate is the foundation of all his movements. That, and to me, that's a spiritual arrangement. Because, you know, whether there's any sex involved or not, it's actually irrelevant in this issue. Simone sometimes said, well, you're so independent, what do I mean to you? And I said, you mean everything to me.
Well, now my last question for you is this. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you wish I had?
I can't think of it now. If I think of it later, I'll call you up and say, turn your recorder on.
Okay. Well, Locke, this has been a wonderful journey with you. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks for coming over it's probably improper to plug my wife's literary works.
Hey, this is your interview.
I'd like everybody to know that Carol Simone, that I'm married to, is a wonderful writer. And her first novel was called The Goddess of Fifth Avenue. It's a wonderful book. And her second one is The Kiss of the Shaman. And she's written a bunch of screenplays. And she has a CD out of Being Kuan Yin that is beautifully done if you want to come deep into that kind of spirit. And I'm just very glad I'm married to her.
Call you the proud husband.
Yeah.
All right. We'll close there.
Thank you.
Thank you.